All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF, as it goes and keeps going. How's it go? What's happening? What is happening? How are you? These words on this mic at this point in time, right now, and what follows here in the intro, not the interview. I'm going to be talking to, they might be giants in just a second. John Flansburgh and John Linnell are both here. The Johns are here, or were here. But in the present, that would be after I talk to the Johns. These might be the last words I say in this structure. I put it off. They're going to show the house one more time right after I'm done talking here. And then I set out to purge the shelves and move the shit, folks. The plan is to move the shit, at the very least, to move the recording apparati, to the new space, the new garage, on Friday. And if I'm ambitious, if I'm enjoying the pickup truck, I'm going to load it up and take the rest on Saturday. And we'll start broadcasting there from the clutter, from back like the old days. Back when this garage was just a garage. It's got to start somewhere. Yeah, before I get all this stuff on the shelves, it's going to be the mics at a table, just like we're starting over. But this is it. This is it. I'm making some decisions about the books. I'm thinking about releasing Gravity's Rainbow back into the used book ecosystem so someone else can put it on their shelf for a couple of decades with plans of embarking. But this is it. I'm looking around and I'm ready to take it down. I'm ready to take the pictures off the wall. I'm ready. And I want to thank all you people for being here through this process of, thank you for mediating the separation. A lot of people are interested in buying the house. I think that's going to happen pretty quickly too. And I'm going to be moving not far, 6 miles away into a new, slightly more spacious garage with a bathroom. I'm going to bring the foam from the ceilings, bring all the pictures and the books, going to absorb some sound in there too. I'm going to refine the book collection. I'm going to miss this place. I'm going to miss it. Yep. But this is it. These are the words. All right. Did I mention to you, I think I mentioned briefly at the end of the last show that I watched all of the Stranger Things in 2 days. In preparation to talk to David Harbour. I wanted to watch a few, but then I ended up watching all of them. And, for the first five or six, it hit some triggers. I make the mistake of thinking that, that I'm not a fantasy guy, that I'm not, a sci-fi guy. But if there are kids involved and they're at an age where the emotions are raw and also they're socially awkward, it gets me right in the guts. And I'm emotionally attached. And I just thought the performances were amazing, but I locked in because of the kids. And, also because this kind of stuff, this is another reason why I learned about myself, is I don't like watching sci-fi or reading sci-fi because it hits my shadow government button. It hits my conspiracy button. It reopens my portal into the what is it called? The upside down, which is the dark part of my brain. Because for about the first five or six episodes of Stranger Things, I was like, yep, this adds up. Makes sense. Adds up. I'm a little vague on how she manifested the whole. But yeah, MK Ultra and stuff. I could see how this could lead to the psychic phenomenon, then the symbiotic relationship of the psychic phenomenon with the actual parallel universe, that it's not just in your mind, but you think it is. But we all know, and I talked to David Harbour about it in an upcoming episode, about the elves on the perimeter, the elves on the periphery, the weird faceless, tooth-filled monkey dogs that are just, just there. If you just look out the side of your eye, there's a little flickering going on. I know it's there. So it triggered that. But thankfully, they didn't explore it thoroughly enough for me to get truly freaked out by my own thoughts about, what is reality. But I was able just to enjoy it. So there you go. Not that it needs a great review from me, but I just wanted you to know that I am apparently a latent sci-fi fantasy fan. I'm not ashamed of it, because I don't want to say that I am a real fantasy or sci-fi fan, because then I'd have to embark on that and go to Comic-Con and decide which characters I'm going to dress up as, do cosplay. There's a lot of it's not going to happen. I just wanted to say that I can open my heart to it if the journey is, you know, kids who are awkward rising above and saving the world. Like, I can get into that. My heart feels that. I mean, I'm not dead inside, folks. This is it. The last of me talking in here. Oh, God. No, I'm not going to cry again. Enough with the crying. So, listen, folks. They might be giants. They're here. The Johns. Their most recent album is I Like Fun. It came out earlier this year, and you can get it wherever you get music. And I enjoy talking to the Johns. They might be giants a great deal. One of them, the larger John, is quite the chatterbox. Was that condescending? I had a good time. This is me and They Might Be Giants, John Flansburgh and John Linnell. John and John.
Sir.
Yes.
They Might Be Giants.
Here we are.
You're in my my garage.
I know.
This is exciting.
I'm glad we got to be in your historic garage before it's turned over to the Smithsonian Institution.
Well, the people really...
Right next to Julia Child's kitchen.
Is it in there? Julia Child's kitchen?
Yeah, they have a reproduction of it. And by the way, if you do go, take a photograph of the wall, because it has a fine wine list of the... It has like a...
Of the day?
It has a chalkboard of all the wines that she needs to buy.
Oh, my God. And so it's just... It was
like
just
a little,
there.
A nice guide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, some people thought I should do something with this place, but I don't know that... I guess it was culturally relevant. I don't know if it's historical in the big scheme of things.
Well, I mean, I've been...
Not fishing for compliments, either. I'm just throwing it out
Sure,
there.
Sure.
Hold on a minute.
Listen.
But I want to get my tea.
Okay.
You guys got stuff. Where's mine?
We need our stuff.
We're talking like we're doing this already, but I can't tell.
I don't know.
Is this a thing that he does?
Mark has left the room.
So have we started already? Are we okay?
Of course.
All right.
What do you think?
It's hard to tell. We just jumped right in.
Mark, I had to tell you.
I gave you more of an intro than I give anybody. I said John and John.
You did do that.
Those were
That's
extremely
true.
Pro.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
I just want to say I've been listening to the show really from almost day one.
Really?
Yeah. And I thought it was a very interesting show.
Yeah.
I remember actually recommending it to a bunch of people because I thought they could handle it.
Handle it. He's a very needy broadcaster.
I have to say, I thought at first I thought like the WTF title.
Yeah.
It's a huge governor on how popular it could ever be.
Yeah.
You know, you're not
you thought it was a mistake or
you're
it was
not,
good?
You're not getting it on NPR, but then you got it on NPR with a different title.
I know.
You're fooling everybody.
Well, then the title initially was a broad title for an unclear idea.
Right.
That you know, in the first dozen or so shows, we were kind of all over the place.
I remember the comedy bits.
Yeah, we had comedy bits. That guy Matthew, my friend Matthew, was in the room.
They were oblique.
Yes.
Comedy bits. Like they did not land. There was no place to land for.
Oh, you
things.
Mean the fake characters?
The fake characters.
Oh, that
yeah.
was here.
The third act.
The third act was here. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you guys? The last time I saw you was at Fred's house.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Tomaselli, the artist.
Yes.
And I'd never met you before. And Fred's a dear friend of my girlfriend Sarah,
yep,
the painter.
Yep.
And they're painters.
She's fantastic.
Yeah, you like her?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I do too. She's painting now. But Fred is a hell of a guy, hell of a painter.
He's terrific. He's a very good friend of mine. I mean,
how long did you know him?
We've been sort of goofing around together since the late 80s, early 90s, I guess.
We actually all lived in Williamsburg at a time when if you met someone under 40 on the Bedford Avenue stop, you would stop them and say, hey, we should be friends, because there just weren't that many people around. It was bohemian in the true sense of the word, which is that like nobody would want to be that way.
Yeah. But when, I mean, where did you, so you guys both still live in Brooklyn?
Yeah, I live in Brooklyn. Yeah. Flans moved to a secret location.
I spend most of my time in Sullivan County in the Catskills, near where the Woodstock event actually happened.
That's where you spend your time now?
Most of my time, yeah.
And if you're not there, you're at his house?
No, I have an apartment in East Harlem that is nice.
Mm-hmm.
East Harlem, it can be revealed.
It can be revealed. I've not talked about it in public until right now.
Who are you concerned is going to take that information and be bad with it?
Well, we're such a Brooklyn identified band that it's like it's a very weird thing to have.
Yeah, left. It's like me wearing glasses.
Right.
It's like you don't want it to be a big thing.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. As you evolve.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because
people
who are committed to you, who have been with you the whole ride, are like, well, now what?
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, we were in Williams.
I don't know what to believe.
We weren't ready for the change.
Right.
Yeah.
I moved to Williamsburg in, I guess, 82. Yeah. Now moved there in like 83. And so we were there for a very long run. And of course, you know, nothing in New York stays the same. And it just turned into this kind of Euro disco extension of St. Mark's Place. It was never my dream to live in St. Mark's Place.
Did it?
It is extraordinarily new. They've torn down everything and
In terms of the way it looks.
They don't literally have, they haven't built a tunnel from St. Mark's to.
But like Eurodisco, when I lived in Astoria,
around,
in the courtyard behind my building, there was a bar there called Boomerang. I think it was, I want to say Baltic. I don't, it wasn't Euro, but it was.
Oh, no, I mean like, you know, like that, those, that Mark, that character on SNL, sort of like, like high-end German,
I get it.
You know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. We're right, buying New York.
Not this the original Polish
Unka. That stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there was the Unkas with the strange, like, Middle
that
Eastern
stuff would
beat.
I would be fascinated to live near that.
I can't even do it. It's like, it's not 4-4, it's something else.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing that's kind of engaging.
The 16th, like, 32nd.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
it cannot be... A beat that cannot be sung.
It's like Egyptian-y.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that possible?
It could be.
You guys are the scientists.
It's not the music. It's not the music that's the problem.
No, I get it. It's the people that own
it's
New York.
It's the lifestyle choices.
But let's go back, because I want to go back to the day, back in the day, because I'm not getting nostalgic with my own life, but I think we must be around the same age.
Probably, yeah.
We're a little bit older than you, I think.
Are you really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Really?
Is that true? When did you show up in Astoria? When were you?
I think I was in Astoria. How's that going to determine my age?
Right? I don't know. I'm triangulating. I'm starting by triangulating.
I think we ended up in Astoria in like 94, 95.
Okay, all right. So you were here before that, and...
I was here in the late 80s for a couple of years, then I went back to L.A.
Okay.
To New York in... like 92.
You've lived almost everywhere.
Yeah, and then I went to San Francisco for a couple of years, but then I was back in New York like 92, 93, and then I dug back in 94, got married 95, got that place in Astoria, held on to it for a while.
Yeah, we were old guys by that time.
Is that the Jody Lennon place?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I held on to that for a while. I think she's still in it.
She is.
Yeah, I ran into
asthmatic cat.
Wait, how's Stoli doing?
I think he's doing good.
They're both okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Good, good.
Okay. I mean, my wife is friends, so I'm not like close with them.
We do run in similar circles. Then I ran into you in a circle that I'm new to.
Right.
But I didn't know you, but I feel like we have similar friends. But I was sort of in a dirtier world than you, I feel like.
It's possible. Although we had more time to clean up, because we got to New York in 81, I think.
Yes.
Right. And we were probably 21, 22.
Oh, you are older than me.
We're definitely older than you, yeah.
I'm 54.
I'm 58.
I'm 57.
Yep. So not, but it's still generationally.
How many minutes before we're talking about the Beatles? How many minutes before we're talking about the Beatles?
No, you're not going to get that from me.
Okay.
I mean, I could see
all
it.
All right, then, the Rolling Stones.
That's fine. I can talk about the Rolling Stones. You know that...
you got two boxes to check off.
But you guys didn't grow up in New York.
No, I did partly.
I'm going to yell that at you. You didn't grow up there.
I didn't. I still haven't grown up, but I lived in New York till I was 8. Moved to the suburbs of Boston, where John and I met.
Suburbs of Boston.
Suburbs of Boston.
Now that was
Metro West, as it's called now.
Right. Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's all the .com millionaires.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's all techie now.
What part are we talking about?
The Tom Schultz-y part.
I got the Walkman right back there.
Yeah,
exactly.
Tom Schultz-y's Walkman.
No, he lived in the town of Lincoln.
We grew up in this beautiful town called Lincoln.
What's that near?
It's near
Concord and Lexington.
It's basically between both of those. Yeah. For a long time, it was unincorporated lands between like all these Revolutionary War towns.
Right.
And then I guess maybe, I don't know when it was actually, it didn't have a school for a long time. There weren't that many people there. Lincoln. It's like 20 minutes west out of Boston, and it's a beautiful, beautiful. It's where the Audubon Society is. I mean, it's that beautiful.
I miss it. It's
a very pretty place.
You know, I did a lot of time in New England, but
it can feel like doing time.
It can, but like when I was there, I was in college, so I was sort of oblivious to the nature of the city itself. And it wasn't until I started doing comedy where I realized, wow, it's a pretty intense out here in some of these suburbs.
But there's a lot of ideas going around. But the thing that we were just talking yesterday or 2 days ago about the strange thing about Boston now, and this is true of all cities everywhere, but like I was recently back in Central Square, which is a place I hung out a lot in the 70s.
Sure.
And Central Square, I mean, it wasn't Times Square filthy, but it was like taxi driver, cigarette butt.
It was
like
a dirtier one.
It was an extremely dirty, like, it was definitely like, you know, there would be like a trash can, and in the trash can, there would be a porn magazine.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It was that kind of place. Like, it was a very kind of raunchy.
But it was weird, wasn't it? Because
it was a morbidly obese kind of neighborhood.
Right. But people used to say, like, you know, can you believe it's that close to Cambridge? Like, it's that close to Harvard Square.
Right.
But it was really only a few blocks. I mean, Central Square was
a five minute walk.
But it's very interesting about Boston. In San Francisco, to some degree, though, it's a little more spread out, is that, you know, like the zone, combat zone, was like four blocks.
Right.
It was like nothing.
Oh, it's a tiny town for sure.
You know,
but the thing is, it's also, that's all gone. Like when you go to Central Square now, it's just like a gigantic Old Navy.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's been erased.
Is the Middle East still there?
It is like the club?
The Middle East?
Oh, yeah, that's still there. That's still there.
TT the Bears?
I'm not sure about TT the Bears.
Is Calcutta the Indian restaurant?
The people there? We did a New Year's show or around New Year's show at TT the Bears and our audience bought so few drinks that the managers of TT the Bears asked that we never return.
Did you pack it though?
It was sold out. They sold like, you know, one beer.
That was Boston.
Yeah. But our
you attract good people.
Our audience is a very sober crowd. But it was a night that like heavily relied on drink sales.
Sure. Like a bar, you mean? Like a club where you play music?
Well, but that's the thing. It's like, you know, like when you go from clubs to theaters, everything changes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Like the dynamic changes because the promoters aren't looking to sell.
You're not in the business of selling drinks.
Right. So
you're in the business of selling tickets.
You can be a different kind of act.
Of course. You can be an act that plays at a place where you're proud to have your fans come. There's not going to be an element.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys ever had to deal with that.
We've had elements.
Yeah?
I'm trying to think if we had elements in our Boston shows.
Well, I'm thinking, it seemed like there was a stretch there. I'm almost positive my mother is going to hear this podcast, which is one of the disturbing things about the internet is that
she can just do it.
Your mom can catch up with you. Yeah. We just got an interview request from High Times.
Yeah.
And they were like, they would just like you to discuss your drug, your life with drugs, like even in the past tense. Yeah. And I'm like, my mom's gonna. I don't really know if I want to go.
How much of a life with drugs did you guys have?
I don't want to talk about it here. I don't want to talk about it here either.
but you're a grown ass man.
Yeah, but it's like, but you
what
know,
are you hiding from your mother, John? Maybe it's time to let it out.
Let me just speak to Polly Flansburgh now if I could. There's nothing to talk about.
Okay, I'll admit it.
I've done
no drugs.
So that's what you're hiding.
What I'm hiding.
There is no mystery.
That's the part we don't want to get out. It's not John's mom that doesn't need to know.
Right. But anyway, I was just thinking back on the shows. We did a show at, what was the place in Jamaica Plain that we played a bunch of times.
Oh.
It was like a very, it was in mid, early 90s. It was like
what was that
proto
place?
Grunge moment. And the Pixies opened up for us, which was before they were famous, and it was an amazing show.
Yeah.
I thought that was Green Street Station.
Green Street Station? Is that
I believe
is
that's that, where we played with the Pixies before their album came out.
Sure. Yeah, that, like they were a virtually unknown band, and it was like one of those things where I mean, it was kind of like being in a club and you know, I mean, I've had this experience a couple of times. I saw Elvis Costello before his record came out, and that was like, it was a very similar
Where?
Thing. It was like in London.
Oh, yeah?
I saw his, basically
before
his first
record?
Yeah, before his first public show. And it was a very similar experience where you're just like, oh. Like, because, you know, you see a lot of good bands.
Yeah.
You know, you certainly, yeah. you know, we've yeah. seen, had a lot of great, we've had sure. amazing openers and, you know, very talented people. But like when you see something that's just like, oh, this is like something
bigger than we
completely, understand. You know, this yeah. is, this is some musical unobtainium.
Yeah.
You know, and, but the thing is, I think my mom came to that show.
Oh, and she said those boys
no,
look
no,
like
no,
druggies.
No, 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 but then there
look
was
at a, that girl.
I'm not sure if it was a triple bill or if this was a, like a show that
I think you're right. No, it was the same show and
but
there was a third act.
There was a third act. Okay, you describe.
And it was a man doing performance art, and he was dressed as in a full body length vagina outfit, which you know
was
completely
Ames?
For as far as we were our performances in New York, this would be like completely ordinary. Like,
was this in New York?
Yeah,
no,
bring
this
the,
is in Boston.
Bring the vagina guy out.
Yeah,
right. He's on next.
They might right. They might be giants around. We need a vagina.
Was
act.
It was it the Mangina?
Is that what it was? It was a Boston act. We don't know what, but
I don't remember what he was called.
I don't think it particularly went over. I mean, it was a very.
How could that go over? How's it going to go away? What do you do for the second minute?
Right.
I think it was about his. He had raps, and
right.
I forget what he talked about. Oh. But he was like, he was saying stuff about himself, and that was his outfit.
Ladies and gentlemen, Get It Off Me Productions introduces the man in the full size,
but,
you know,
but
human
basically,
size.
Every time. John's mom came out to see us, there'd be some appallingly transgressive thing, and it happened in New York.
It happened.
And it
yeah,
happened
the
in
same
Boston.
Thing happened in New York and, with the guy who
guy dressed as a giant cock.
That was actually that's too weird to talk about.
But the point is,
the one in New York's too weird to talk about.
The point is, I think she probably got used.
Your
to
Your mother
it after
already
a while.
Went
she,
through
she,
it.
She became inured to the idea.
What happened in New York? You can't just like you know say it.
Well, it's also it's sort
it was
of
a, it was
sort
a,
of an I don't know.
It was a guy with no arms wearing
yeah.
a dress
yeah.
who was doing performance art, and
uh-huh.
he was mostly in German.
Uh-huh.
I think he was like saying stuff in German,
and that was the
and then he did a, and then his friend did a striptease while
is that
he was,
what it was?
While he was
yeah,
reciting
maybe.
Stuff.
Was he the
know.
Closer? Or you, they open for you?
I don't.
It was on one of these bills where
you know
PS 122 in New York.
Like,
they would have like 100 different acts.
It was
on.
A variety show.
Yeah,
but this is important because
well,
this is New York
up,
in 19 what 82?
89, 90.
Because this is like just, it's sort of the end of that performance art.
Oh
thing.
Yeah.
We basically started like when we arrived in New York. New York was like the new wave fad was which was in some ways kind of a hoax.
The resurrection of new wave.
No wave.
Right.
No
yeah,
wave.
Sure.
Like,
sure.
Like 1981, 82. There was like
suicide.
Suicide musically fits in, but I don't even know if they ever even had any audience at all. The hot acts were like DNA.
Yeah.
Lydia Lunch.
Right.
The Contortions, which is a fantastic
the
act.
Swan.
Is Swans were part of their.
Yeah.
I think like Live Skull, maybe
yeah.
sort of like proto. Sonic Youth kind of stuff,
right.
Glenn Branca stuff. That stuff was all kind of getting a lot of notice. But the thing that was weird, the thing that they all had in common is that audiences hated it.
Yeah.
So there was like this weird void, and because of that, clubs were all these clubs that we were arriving in New York thinking like, you know, we're just going to slide into like I think we sort of thought like, you know, we were new wave guys.
But were you
like,
gonna, okay,
we were
but
punk rock guys.
You put it together. So you grew up in Lincoln. You met in Lincoln?
Yeah.
You grew up together.
Yeah,
correct.
He's a year older than me, so we didn't really become friends until high school.
But do you remember? Oh, okay. So you don't remember him moving with his family?
Oh, no,
when he was eight?
I remember him when he was eight, yeah.
Yeah?
It was a small school.
I wasn't aware of John
Nine.
At that time.
The awkward
yeah.
kid who showed up. He remembers you because he did something terrible.
This is new information.
Oh,
no.
Really?
I mean, I didn't have like a strong... Trust me, you did not make a strong impression on me. Don't flatter yourself.
Hey.
But you remember when the new kid showed up.
When I showed up, everything changed.
Yeah, yeah. My whole life changed. No, it was you know, it was fine.
Yeah?
It was fine.
So, but in high school, you became friends?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. We both worked on the newspaper together.
So, newspaper nerds.
Correct.
Yeah. So you were doing layout? You were doing
yep.
what?
Yeah.
He was the editor of the paper.
We were writing articles, which were basically like one of the teacher advisors was like, you should just call this Vanity Fair.
Oh,
he was right.
Why?
Because we were writing for ourselves.
Well, because the problem was like, you know, the function of most high school papers is to like write stories about like the football team.
Right.
But there was nobody on the paper who even could fit. Well, I mean, we did actually
didn't go
fake,
to games. Couldn't
we would get submissions of articles about what happened at the football game. And it was a good expository writing lesson to try to figure out how to write an interesting article about a football game that you hadn't seen. You know, so well, that was a good...
That's a whole school of journalism in and of itself.
Yeah, it's like, this was a fantastic game. And so you know, I wrote some of those articles, I'll admit it.
And all right, so you're hanging out, and what's going on musically at that time? This is 76, 77?
Yeah, it's like, in there. I had started playing piano, just teaching myself, and John owned a tape recorder.
Oh, very important.
But was not a musician.
Like
sort of obsessed with sound.
Yeah, I get that. So like a regular tape recorder or a four track?
I saved up like summer job money to buy a Tascam 3340.
Oh, yeah.
Four-track simul-sync tape recorder. Most importantly, there were no drum machines, which is really the key element to...
So you had to record
if you did anything with a pulse, if you had wanted something with a pulse, you'd have to find a pulse-making thing or make your own.
Right.
You could concoct... And also, a lot of times you would do stuff with like tape loops.
Yeah.
And because it's a loop, you can kind of create like a pulsing thing out of the loop.
Yeah, I knew a guy that was very into layering things and doing. I remember we did a recording at his house on something similar to that, and he did a drum loop on playing with the sticks on a guitar case and just like layered that in.
Absolutely,
right?
God, it's so good.
It comes up against this idea that I think is sort of like there's a lot of. I mean, this idea comes up on your show a lot, which is the thing that's more fun to do than it is to experience as an audience.
Yeah.
And I think the problem with that kind of music, like the bedroom rock in general, is it's really fun to make, but it's not particularly fun to listen to.
But now when you say bedroom rock, you're talking about, you know, like Brian Eno.
That's anybody.
I mean, anyone that's working in their studio
It felt like, it didn't feel that different than probably Brian Eno in some ways. I mean, I think Brian Eno's probably better at it than
he's got a nicer bedroom and nicer equipment.
Well, I don't know how good how much it matters, like if how good the equipment is.
No, I think you're right. I think the excitement of discovery that you can do when you get a handle on that technology has got to be just mind blowing. I mean, just like if you have that kind of focus,
it's
you're
completely
like,
magical.
You're in all day. You're in.
It's super fun.
Exactly.
There's nothing more fun. Yeah.
So you met him and he had the Tascam.
He had the tape recorder. I had the a few years into our friendship. Two things. I started playing with a new wave band, and you picked up a guitar that your friend had given you which had only three strings.
Yeah,
and started to teach yourself just the first three strings.
This is one of those this altered guitar sort of discovery invention.
Not intentionally.
Catharsis.
I think it was more like you only had three strings, and so you started with that.
Well,
and
it was also I had.
You didn't know it needed more.
Well, I could make chords with it, and that was all I felt like needed
to. That's not even a full ukulele.
No. But it was sort of like punk rock amnesty day. Like, it was 1977. Like, there was, you know, I remember
You don't need all the strings for punk rock.
I saw the Sex Pistols, you know, like, our friend Jimmy, who was like a big Cream magazine kind of, I feel like Lester Bangs is kind of like, if you just think of Lester Bangs, he's like the Lester Bangs of our personal life.
Right.
Like, he introduced us to
you had to have
things.
One at that
like
time.
Like, he played us like Patti Smith's Piss Factory, and he played us like the Ramones. Like, the first time I heard the Ramones was like in his attic room, you know, and he had a copy of the Ramones, and
how great was that?
You've got to listen to this. We fell out. You know, it was just like, this is the most insane... You know, because part of it that was so great was that it was incredible.
Never happen again.
It was incredibly powerful music.
It'll never happen again.
It was
again.
Incredibly powerful music. And also, there's this part of it that's like, is this a joke?
Yeah.
Like, right. And the combination of like, is this a joke? And it being so good.
Right.
You know, it's like, what they're talking about is so fucked up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, there's
sniffing
like,
glue
like,
and.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, and it's like without, no apologies. No, they're not bragging.
Yet because of the type of music it is, it almost sounds like novelty music.
Yeah. Well,
but it rocks so hard.
It rocks so hard. I mean, it's not, and I mean, it asks a lot more questions than it answers. That's
I like that. That's an interesting sort of reaction to the Ramones. Like, is this a joke? But like, then you realize how hard it's rocking. It's like undeniably not a joke.
There's a great cassette tape of that Danny Fields made of Lou Reed that was recorded in a recording studio right after Denny Fields played him the Ramones.
Yeah.
And it's a very similar thing.
Yeah.
And like Lou Reed is just like, that's it. That's it. I'm done. We're done. It's over. Forget it. They nailed it. They did it. They did it. And it's like this. It's like, what? You know?
Yeah.
Like, and like, you know, you think about Lou Reed. Like Lou Reed is the guy who does like the press conference in Japan with like 800 people there. Yeah. He's like, I don't want to talk about it. Yeah. What are you people doing?
But Lou Reed, you know, Lou Reed had this, he had an advantage over us, which is he kind of came from that same world.
He invented something.
But he also came from the working class New York thing.
Oh, that's right.
And so part of the mystery for us was like, we're these suburban kids who are like, what are these guys doing? You know?
But like, on some level, like, you know, you got to, there has to be this timeline where Lou Reed knows that without him, that whole thing down there doesn't happen.
I'd be curious to know how much he credited himself.
I don't think sound-wise, but certainly in terms of pushing the envelope and pushing it in New York.
Yeah, yeah,
and making room.
But
for
also,
things.
I think New York also just grows stuff like that.
I think that's true. So, it just grows Ramones.
Right.
There are a lot of Ramones.
But also, I mean, I think musicians often, you know, nobody wants to admit it, but like they, you know, they will feel competitive with their contemporaries.
Sure.
And nothing is like as much like when you play a rock festival. It's like, you know,
yeah,
behind the scenes, it's like, well, who won? I'm sure it's the same.
I don't do it with comedy much because it's, you know, it's not fair in the sense that,
because you're lying to yourself.
No, because like, you know, after a certain point, you realize that certain comics with certain audiences are going to do
they've
certain
got
things.
Right. Of course.
I think that's the same with music.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Last night I went out and I rarely play publicly, mm-hmm. you know, and I took my Les Paul Deluxe.
Oh, you played music publicly?
Yeah, Jimmy Vivino.
Oh, he's a very generous guy.
Hey, Jimmy?
Yeah.
He's great.
A nice guy.
Well, he does a night out in Burbank at this joint. So, and he said, come down and play a couple. And I was like, oh my God.
Wow.
And, you know, and there's all these old dudes, these old guitar players, and they're just around hanging out. And I definitely felt that, like, God, I hope I can get it up for this. Like, I hope I can land this thing just so I don't feel like I'm, you know, like impotent. There's an almost biological challenge to it that you want to at least show up for yourself.
Right.
And you know, it's not in losing. I knew I was going to lose, but if I could honor what it is that I do, you know, as rough as I do it, and it's mine, then I did all right.
That's interesting. Well, I think we take more of like an auteur approach, where we can not necessarily, you know, do the thing you're talking about.
Yeah.
We can suck pretty hard.
We can suck, but we're hiding behind our ideas.
The thing is that no matter what you guys do, you know, I think it's very similar. Is that, you know, you've created this world for yourself, a sound, a tone,
we've got a voice, a
structure. You're undeniably
we've
you.
We've got a brand. Yeah.
I don't know why I call it a brand. Yeah. Like, why not call it a
universe?
Like, yeah, or just like a voice.
We've got a voice.
I want a universe.
I'll take it.
Because
like, you know, you're like after 2 seconds of one of your songs, you're like, they might be giants. There's no denying it.
But I think like the thing
isn't that what you're trying to do though.
I think I think we're trying to do a lot of different things.
No, I mean at the beginning.
Well, at the beginning.
So the thing about it is that we're doing this for ourselves. You know, primarily like we're trying to impress ourselves. And I think part of it is like, you know how you don't necessarily recognize yourself in the mirror? Like you're so used to getting harder. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Dad?
But you know what I mean? Like you're so used to your own thing that what you're really trying to do is try and expand on it as much as possible. Right. So I don't think, in other words, we'd been doing this for, what was it, like 20 years when before we started doing, we made our first children's record. And one of the reasons we waited so long was we didn't think we didn't want to confuse anybody, you know?
What do you mean?
They'd think this is what they are. Yeah, yeah.
We didn't want people to think that we had fundamentally changed our act.
Well, but let me ask you something, though. I mean, the interesting thing about the timing of that, though, mm-hmm. Looking at it, is that, you know, given that your fans are generally decent people who don't drink, I'm sure that most of them have families. A lot of them do.
That
generation of your, I think.
Well,
do you have kids?
Yes,
you both have kids.
I do not have kids. I have two cats.
Yeah, I have cats. Three cats. No kids. I'm with you. But But you must have known, like, you know, these kids need things. And it'd be nice to entertain them.
Well, John and I did discuss this from the position of, like, kids deserve not just that...
good pop music?
Kind of classic, like, condescending, like, blah, 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 this is good enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
When you do a kid's album, like, people come out of the woodwork telling you, like, how you should do it. They're like, it's like that, the part in The Graduate where the guy says plastics.
Yeah.
It's like that. They're like, dinosaurs. I'm telling you, kids love dinosaurs. And it's true. Kids do love dinosaurs. And one of our most popular songs is about dinosaurs written by our bass player. But the truth is, like, I think what we wanted to do, and John sort of nailed this in one conversation we were having about it, which is like the way people like the adults like the Sopranos. We want to write kids' music that like appeals to kids the way the Sopranos appeals to adults.
Like they're just waiting for the next song.
It's just like surprising. You know, something surprising.
Okay, I get it. Yeah.
Something that like captures their imagination, that takes them to somewhere else, that isn't just like about like fortifying them with like vitamin enriched information
or like a morality tale about a dinosaur.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, it's just
the
like
the dinosaur that broke its foot.
Not everything that kids experience has to be good for them. And I think that was sort of our little breakthrough. We're going to do
the kids album for the dark stuff, for the stuff that they're going to be a little
or
uncomfortable.
It doesn't have to be nutritional. I think
it doesn't have to make them better at being kids.
Oh, I see. Or they don't have to learn.
Yeah, they don't. Exactly. It doesn't have to be.
They
about
don't
being,
have to learn.
And even the records we've done that are, you know, in air quotes like educational, they're still. I mean, they're just interesting records. I mean, it's just, and we dedicate a lot of production value and a lot of time, and like we take on those projects very seriously. Which is the other thing is that the more you do educational, the more you do kid stuff, you realize what a world of hacks. The rest of, I mean, a lot of people doing
it's a racket.
Kid stuff.
Sure,
it's just like, well, I couldn't do the real stuff, so I did some kid stuff.
Oh, really? Like, and a lot of them find success in that.
Oh, you can find tons of success.
That's the cliche, anyway. Like that's, you know.
But I mean, once you get a break with a kid thing, like it's not like the Wild West. Not like anybody can just make a fortune doing kid stuff.
I don't know about fortunes, but you can certainly. I mean, there's a whole regional kids music making.
Yeah, I had Zane's in here from the Del Fuegos,
right?
And he's like the world music kids guy,
right?
Like, and he
makes great kids albums, though. I mean, he
makes he uses great musicians.
Yeah.
But let's go back before we get to exploiting children for money.
we'll come back to the exploiting kids.
That'll be hour two.
No, because I think that like I said at the beginning, the time that you guys sort of surfaced was a very exciting and changing time in music. So you guys, so you're in a band now in Lincoln, a new wave band.
Well, yeah,
it's in
Boston. Moved out to Boston.
And what year is this? 77.
This was 79.
So you moved to Boston.
Moved to
Boston.
Music. Yep.
Where were you living?
Everywhere. You know, like when you're a certain age, you just move every month, basically.
Yeah. Where'd you sort of land it, though? Like, because you're talking about Central Square. You remember Kenmore Square, dude?
Sure.
I mean, that place is just nothing.
He played in Kenmore Square many times at the In Square Men's Bar.
In Square Men's Bar?
Yeah, the Mundanes. The Mundanes were a huge. He was in a band called The Mundanes.
That's the Mundanes.
New Wave band, yeah.
And they were based out of Providence, right on. They were a big, like, brown, rizzy kind of band. And this is right after, like, the Talking Heads had blown up. So there was like this whole sort of like.
So we got to be the Providence. Opening act for every new wave thing that came through Providence.
Through Providence.
Yeah. So we opened for the Ramones and the Talking Heads because there was nobody else that was appropriate.
And this was in the late 70s.
But the post new wave thing, like the early, like late 70s, early 80s stuff, spawned some of the weirdest, most mutant kind of ideas because everyone was like, all right, we've done this short song thing. That and this weird. Hardcore, like post slam dancey, post skinhead, post oi thing. There was like sort of like what I guess like the guy who just died from The Fall, like that kind of music kind of
what's
was
his name?
Really
Mark
E. Smith.
But like I remember, New Wave really set out to kill disco because I was in junior high. I mean, you guys were out already, but like we had a real problem with disco.
Yep.
You know, in 76,
yes,
75.
Oh, see, we kind of loved
you were
this
out.
Stuff. We kind of loved
it. I like it now. I mean, I can listen to it and I can respect it. I have Bee Gees records and Donna Summer.
Well,
you
say,
always liked it?
No, I would say for me, it was treacly horrible stuff until somewhere around I Feel Love by
I Feel Love was a real game changer.
Yeah. That was Donna Summer. Yeah.
Something else.
But Giorgio Moroder.
Giorgio Moroder did the production.
It.
Yeah.
Mm. So he's so it was had this, you know, very German kind of Kraftwerk.
Yeah. Oh, the I didn't get into Kraftwerk till like a year ago.
Jimmy Mac also played us Kraftwerk for the first time. He played us
Kraftwerk and the Ramones.
Yeah.
So he laid out your life for you.
He was the source. Yeah, yeah. It's a shame he's passed away, but he was the sort of the Holy Ghost.
Did you send him Christmas cards every year? Like thank you notes? Hey, dude, thanks.
Oh, we did. We dedicated our first album to him, actually.
Yeah.
Jimmy what?
Jimmy Mac. James McIntyre. He was like an incredible guy. Like, he just, he had really, really...
Kraftwerk and the Ramones. He was like, you guys ready?
Yeah.
He wrote all the music reviews in the newspaper.
School paper?
Yeah. School paper.
And so he was notorious.
But he was writing music reviews about music, I would think, that was very... not popular.
No. I mean, he would write about the popular stuff as well. He was very Lester Bangsy.
Yeah, exactly.
I think like, you know, the whole thing of growing up in the 70s and the time that we did, there were a lot of cultural things that barely even scan now that were so influential. Like just the idea of freeform radio. You know, we make these records that have a lot of different musical styles.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we started without a drummer.
Right.
But and so we were like very free to do any kind of rhythms we wanted to do or any like make arrangements big or small. But I think also just growing up with BCN where they would have the playlist would be this wide open thing where you'd be listening to stuff from the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. It didn't matter what era it was.
Yeah, it was militant. I mean, they play like the Rite of Spring and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
They played. You know,
they were all over the late night too.
Wide.
Who's the late night guy?
They were out, but it was like late night all the time there.
I know.
I mean, it was like it was they were out to blow your mind. Like, they really wanted to change your expectation of what was happening on the radio.
And How great was that?
And like, I think it's almost impossible to describe. It's like saying like there was a time when I mean, I'm not saying it was
children.
Right. I'm not saying it was necessarily the best radio ever made, but it was so different than it's almost inconceivable to me now that somebody would do that.
Well, the mainstream was so defined and so market driven.
Yeah.
So, you know, to get out from under, you know, Bob Seger, you know, at any given point in time.
Yeah.
Was sort of a chore.
Which, they, I mean, they played Bob Seger. It would be hard. You know, I imagine like it maybe wouldn't be that impressive to hear it or to see the playlist. Now, it's like we talk to the younger members of our band about watching Laugh-In when we were kids.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, what the hell is wrong with you? Like, why do you...
It's like, it was like, never funny. And it's
it
like,
was
well,
never funny.
Well,
I was
actually,
like, no, it was funny.
Actually, at a moment, it was, I mean...
it was mind-blowing.
Yeah.
It's hard to get your mind blown so much now.
Yeah.
And like, the Cars were a huge shift.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I saw the Cars' second show because Jimmy Mac took me to it.
Right, so that was a big shift.
Much better when you couldn't understand the lyrics.
Oh, yeah?
Well, and also amazing when you couldn't understand the
lyrics. Also,
they
didn't have like the big three-part harmonies. It was a very... The live show was very different before their first album.
But they were very well rehearsed. And a lot of the new wave... A lot of the bands at The Rat, I would go to all... Every weekend, I would go to The Rat in 77 with my big...
Do you remember Mitch?
I had a fake WBCN ID.
Uh-huh.
And so I could just get in. I was 15 years old.
Yeah.
But I could get into every show with my fake... Jimmy worked at WBCN as a promo guy.
Yeah.
And I would get into the show and we'd get really good seats. We'd be like the first people there.
You'd go downstairs.
Yeah, go downstairs.
Yeah.
I had my cassette tape recorder. Yeah. I'd record everything.
Really?
And and I saw the Cars. And they were shockingly good.
Well, yeah, and going into the basement of The Rat was pretty exciting.
Oh, it was super fun.
You got to play The Rat, I
played,
imagine.
Well, in the Mundanes, we played The Rat. Yeah,
that,
and I can't remember if we...
That
we
horrible back there? Dressing room?
We never played The
I
Rat.
Guess we
the
never,
rat
I guess we... Closed. The Giants never played there.
But, wait, why? Because
for,
it was...
For
it,
people...
You were around then.
I think we actually got... Because we were out of New York... Our real club days were in New York City. I mean, we played every club in New York constantly from like...
Okay, so he's in the Mundanes. When does the thing
we moved,
start?
The Mundanes moved to New York to make it big.
From Providence.
I moved from Ohio, where I'm going to Antioch College, to Pratt Institute to get a degree in fine arts.
Yeah.
And...
What fine art?
Painting, printmaking. Okay. And then... So we move into the same building, which is filled with our friends from from Lincoln and Sudbury.
By coincidence?
No, no.
Well, it's just like...
that's how we... the people that we knew in New York.
You know, yeah. One person, you say, like, yeah. Is there an apartment opening up? It's like, yeah. Yes, there is. It's in the worst building in Brooklyn.
Right.
But we're all there.
There's plenty
which,
of...
by the way, is, plenty, is now entirely unaffordable by, right. by any of us.
Of course.
It's in Park Slope.
Yeah. Wow. It's in Park yeah. Slope, but, like, at the time, it was on a block with, like, one third...
Where you sit there going, like, we're not even really in New York.
I think we kind of like Brooklyn, actually. Yeah. I think yeah. even then, even though it was scary, there it was super high crime and scary. And,
yeah.
And as was, John was about to say, a third of the buildings on the row had actually been torched by the landlords to collect the insurance.
It was that post-Fort like, Apache moment where a lot of landlords'
in the 70s,
buildings were
mid-70s?
Up, no, late, like 1980, 81. Was
oh, really?
When, there was a huge amount of flight out of Brooklyn. And so the buildings became too expensive to make. They didn't want to pay for the, like just paying for the insurance or the
right.
mortgage was killing landlords. So yeah. they would just burn the building down. And it was a little bit of, you know, lightning
yeah.
would strike these
sure.
buildings.
Sure.
And so next, the block over from us was like the heroin.
Thank
district.
You for not saying Jewish lightning.
Well, people use all sorts. There's also Italian lightning.
Yeah.
There's, good. You know, insert your racial, yeah. your racist epithet
right.
here. So
it was ethnic lightning.
Ethnic lightning.
Ethnic lightning was everywhere. And so like the heroin district was right next door to us. And like, I would look out the back I was in a railroad apartment looking out my window and there would just be garbage can fires like every single night. I'm like, why do those people want to light those garbage cans on fire? Like, what's going on out there?
The dope fiends were down there. They were there.
That was the district. The district
all, they were all like, I lived on in Alphabet City. You know, mm-hmm. it's just like there were very defined heroin neighborhoods. All
yeah,
the city.
Yeah. Well, you want to know where you are.
It's a big business. It was yeah. a big business.
So that
brought you guys together.
That put us back in the same place.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
we started sharing equipment. I still had my tape recorder.
I think we actually started doing recordings even when I was still in this other band.
Yeah.
And John was in school. And then gradually that just started to seem like, well, this is more interesting.
On the Tascam?
On the Tascam. Yeah, on the TIAC. Yeah, yeah.
On the TIAC?
It was a TIAC.
Oh, a TIAC. Sorry. So what were you playing? Who was playing what?
Well, John had a Moog synthesizer, which we could then create a pulse with. And we sort of construct these rhythm tracks on the three tracks, bounce them down to one.
Yeah.
And right. then we'd play along and then maybe
I
add
think
a couple
of overdubs.
You had
a bunch of like tambourines and stuff.
Yeah. Right? We yeah. just had like sort of pots and pans. And so we just kind of create these tracks that we would then play. We would rehearse to these tracks. And we
rehearse what?
Songs. Like we would write songs to these rhythm tracks.
I get it. Yeah.
So we were like a two man band.
Yeah.
And then
and you were playing guitar?
I was playing the guitar. I'd sort of learned how to play the guitar. Although when we started, I couldn't sing and play at the same time, which is an idea that really blows my mind. Like
yeah.
It was that raw.
It's hard.
I mean,
it's like juggling.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But now, you know, then the drum machines started coming in very soon after that. Like just emerging.
Yeah.
Chris Butler from The Waitresses actually lent us his DMX drum machine, which is the sound of like King of Rock by Run DMC.
Uh-huh.
It's like all the drum sounds, you know, this is, you know, the snare sound is and the kick drum sound is so everything you do on it, like, you know, you know, it's like you want to do a ballad, how about
right. But it was very synthy, right? In other words, it was not samples.
It was like
the tom-tom was like, doo. You know, it wasn't a recording of a tom.
Yeah, it wasn't a recording. So it was a drum machine.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
emphasis
right.
on machine.
Right,
yeah.
right. They hadn't done the sampling
yeah.
thing yet. Because I remember when that happened, everyone was like, oh my God,
oh,
exactly.
Yeah.
No,
it meant everything
we saw
us.
It was like a truck coming towards us. Because that was developing while we were doing this thing.
Yeah.
But it was kind of
so you
exciting.
Were excited.
We were very excited. Yeah, yeah. And we were very excited to be in a two-man band because the truth is, like, you know, John had been in bands. I was in other bands in college with people. And, you know, it's hard to be in a band. It's hard to, you know, everybody has this sort of like, it's a democracy sort of maybe. Maybe you're with like a visionary person who's got a very clear idea of how to do something great. But the push-pull of a band can make you feel like you're doing something sort of mediocre.
Uh-huh.
Like it's very, like it becomes those, you learn like the problem of things made by committee very quickly being in a band.
Uh-huh.
And I think for both me and John, we wanted to do something that had like no compromises. Like even if it's the most fragile, indefensible idea, like let's just do something that is just like for ourselves that satisfies us.
Well, it was fortunate that you guys thought the same way, I guess.
Yeah,
you're saying you didn't fight each other.
I think we convinced each other. I think there was sort of like
I think we made each other braver.
Yeah, individually and certainly in my earlier bands, I was like, I got to figure out what people want, you know, and do that. What is it? What do they want? And then eventually John and I like discussed and we're like, fuck that, you know, we're going to
don't really need
do
to
a thing
care
we
about
like
what people want.
Yeah.
Let the people come to us. Well, and then the weird thing is, so we kind of like, you know,
but did you think, at that time we're sort of like, we're doing things that we cannot perform live.
There was, yes. There, that was a part of, that was something we wanted to make sure we didn't do too much of. We didn't want the tape. We restricted the tape to just be rhythms and a bass line. And we didn't really have too many things that were like sound effects driven or like we even though it was years before Milli Vanilli, I think we had an awareness that we didn't want the track to like overwhelm what we were doing on stage. So we kind of had a little bit of a governor on what was on the track. But to be perfectly honest, and I realized in the fullness of time, our impression was for a lot of people was not the same.
What do you mean?
We thought we were a real band. I mean, like, we thought there was no shortcoming to what we were doing.
I think like, maybe, because I remember discussing this, like, at some point I said something about how, like, quaint the drums were, and you were like, what are you talking about?
Right. Know, like, I mean, personally, as the guitar player in the band, like, I felt like we were, you know, we were AC/DC, man. Like, you know, we were like rocking, like when we were really rocking out, we were rocking out as hard as anybody rocks out.
Yeah.
And it was like totally visceral and physical and real.
Yeah.
And the fact that there was like a drum machine behind us, like, yeah, there's a drum machine behind us because drum machines are the coolest things in the world. Like, you wish you had a drum machine. You just got a drummer. We've got a drum machine.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't make mistakes. It doesn't get high before the show.
Yeah.
Deal with that.
Remember John saying this thing about like somebody who'd seen Van Halen playing in one of the earliest gigs at a tiny club, and they were playing as if they were playing in a gigantic stadium,
sure,
like right from the beginning,
right?
And how crazy, like how deluded you have to be to convince yourself that that's, you know.
Yeah.
But then that carries you, you know, then people get the three guys watching, you're like, I just saw the most awesome show. I
mean, and then the truth is
like, it like your Pixies moment where you're it's like, oh my God, this is bigger than life. But they were doing something no one
they were doing
really
something. They were doing something else. But you know, the truth is like our luckiest break is that, you know, even though we had made the decision that we weren't going to sort of, you know, try to calculate what audiences want. I mean, I think there are a lot of performers and a lot of songwriters who do a really good job of like, they do a very good job of figuring out what satisfies people. Even though we had kind of put that on the shelf, audiences took to what we were doing almost right away. I think they saw, maybe they saw a lot of themselves reflected in what we were doing, like that we, you know, we might not have reminded them of Mick Jagger, but we probably reminded them of their, like, you know, crazy creative brother.
I it's hard to reconstruct what people made of it, and
but I guess
yeah, it definitely went over.
Well, you found your audience pretty quickly.
Yeah,
immediately.
It began with friends. You know, we had friends come to see us,
and this before the first record.
Yes. There's a long interval before,
there was a little, you know, as you know, there was like a little scene in the East Village, So it turned out it wasn't CBGB. It was these performance
spaces.
The Pyramid Club, APC, sure. Dorinka.
Yeah, those places.
The Pyramid where?
Pyramid Club on Avenue A.
Yeah, I know that
one. Was wildly successful at the time. I mean, the mid-80s scene was like when performance art was really happening. And we folded into that perfectly.
Like the second generation of the performance artists.
Right? Yeah, not Soho, like Loft performance art.
Right.
This was much more gonzo. Like there's a lot of drag. There was a lot of really transgressive stuff I would invite my mother to.
Right.
Yeah. And
then there were these campy musicians and things that...
Who were some of the other ones?
I mean, we did shows with like... I mean, the bands that made it out... Well, one thing... The bands that made it out of there... Like, you know, were Live Skull, Butthole Surfers, you know, I mean, Sonic Youth, but
you're very different from them.
Yeah,
I mean,
you're
almost like musically the opposite.
We would be like, you know, we'd be like at the top of the bill, and they would be at the end of the bill.
So
they'd have performance art in the middle. The performance art was the big draw.
Right,
and
those things. So it'd be like Karen Finley
the headliner. Or Popo or, you know, something.
I get it.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, trying to frame. So
it was not a rock scene.
So right, but what you were doing were sort of finely kind of crafted pop songs with it.
We had a lot of transgressive stuff in the beginning,
like
started these screamy songs that really went over great, but like on record sound unlistenable.
Wait, you guys telling me that you did like noise rock, like no wave kind of? Yeah.
Not quite. Well, I mean, it was musical, but also there it involved like John had a gigantic, and we've still done this recently. He had a tree trunk that he would bash on the stage,
which was mic'd,
which had a mic on it.
Sounded great.
And we did, you know, like we did. I think we were like trying to fit in to some extent. We did a thing where we had an egg.
Kind of art rock?
We had an egg
that
spoke to the audience, and then we did a magic trick where we crushed the egg.
Right, so you had a comedy bit.
It's kind of, I don't know if it was funny, but we smashed the egg.
It was not.
It started singing, and we smashed it, and then it continued singing. That was the, that's what I remember of that particular.
So you had an act.
It was an act.
Very,
yeah.
It was all very much an act.
Yeah, it was an act.
I mean, you know, in those clubs, props didn't mean what they mean in like a comedy
venue. I know.
That's the weird thing is that it recontextualized everything. Like really reshuffled it.
But there was always a comic element to a lot of performance art, whether they wanted to be there or not. And
that's not
in a mocking way. Is that when you go over the top, whether it's with drag or with cans of yams or nudity, whatever you're going to do, that you're elevating something to a burlesque.
Oh, you're right.
A
lot of people thought the Karen Finley yam thing was funny.
Yeah.
It was transgressive and it was funny, even though she was deadly serious and actually acting out a lot of serious issues.
Yams is a funny word. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But the thing is that environment was sort of allowed anything. It was completely permissive.
Right.
So it was permissive to the degree where if you didn't take chances that were somewhat extraordinary, you were a bore.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It was very sensationalist.
Yeah.
And the thing that was interesting about coming up as an act at that time, and we played every weekend, like 84, 85, 86. I've got a calendar of like all the shows we did. We played virtually every weekend, at least one show, sometimes two.
Right.
Which was an insane thing in New York City. Like there were so many venues to do this stuff and such a huge audience. There were so many venues of 100 people, 150 people, and they just wanted something new. They wanted something different, and it was not a rehearsal. It was not a showcase club. There was no notion that anyone was careering.
Right.
There was no end destination. There was no final place that you would go. Like it's not like and what do you call your act? Like it was just like it was just the thing that was happening in that moment.
Yeah,
you weren't auditioning,
and also
anything.
You were like, it's an odd, did you have the
accordion?
So you had the accordion then. So you had a physicality. You had a strange lack of instruments. You had an old instrument.
Yeah.
You had clever lyrics and a look. So you were kind of part of the freak show.
Yeah, a little
I
bit.
I guess so. Not in a bad way.
No.
Yeah.
I think we didn't feel like as big freaks as probably some people thought we were.
Right.
But, you know what I mean?
I think we felt like our side was winning.
Yeah. Well, it did.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that you were sort of ahead of the curve in, like that an audience, whatever audience you built around you initially and whatever audience came from the first hit records that you had, that, whatever culture has become now in this sort of nerd, the broader nerd branding world, you were ahead of the curve on that.
I guess, although in some ways I feel like that a lot of that stuff, like the stuff we've been talking about that scene is like so gone now.
No, I know, but like once you guys started making sweet songs and the sweet people started coming to see you and not drinking, that was sort of a precursor to what became a dominant force in culture.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. It's definitely no longer a UFO. I mean, it's we can play a song. And
it's something that can be described.
I feel like when we talk to younger bands, we realize like a lot of young people are not worried about any of these issues about like selling out and stuff like that we were obsessed with at that.
Selling
at
out
that
in terms of like, maintaining your integrity?
Yeah. Or yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Like the idea of integrity seems to have gone away.
That's gone now, right?
No, that now they call it authenticity, and it's a little more flexible.
Yeah, authenticity. Authenticity.
You can actually hold on to your authenticity and compromise your integrity.
Exactly. Yeah. How do we do that? We've got to learn how to do that.
I remember seeing like an ad. I remember seeing the Red Hot Chili Peppers very early on in their career.
Yeah.
We had gotten, actually, the very first record offer we got was from the label that they were on.
EMI.
Which label?
I think it was EMI, which was like, I think, one of the most Coke-fueled labels of that era. And they were not a particularly successful act, but they obviously, you know, had like an incredible look.
Who, the Peppers?
The Chili Peppers. Yeah. And they did an ad for, I think, Nike or some sort of on-trend Swatch.
Yeah.
Some hipsterish kind of big 80s thing. They did a television ad, and it was like watching TV. You know, I'm watching like the Phil Donahue show, and all of a sudden, the Red Hot Chili Peppers were on television, and you know the Ringo Sexual in me just was like, you're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, you gave away your cool card.
Right. You know, now I was thinking like, well, now the Red Hot Chili Peppers will like never be able to work again. and it was sort of climbing down from that preset to like where we are now, where people just think like that's the best thing that could ever happen to you would be to be in a Nike commercial. I don't feel old. I feel like I am from another world.
Extinct, right.
You know, like,
what do you remember when the Del Fuegos did that Miller commercial?
Well, that was a contentious thing.
That was a big deal, actually.
That was a contentious thing.
Because, they chose them to represent Boston.
Well, part of that was weird is that, I think the
Frisson?
Was that it was about authenticity.
Uh-huh.
Right.
So, like, it was like, you don't want the topic to be authenticity in the thing that scans as a commercial.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a little little bit difficult.
But that sort of ended that.
A heavy
didn't
lift.
It?
Well, I don't know, but we perceived it as a bad move at the time.
Yeah.
Because
you were around?
Because we had those concerns, you know, like we were.
But everything kind of was, there were so many everything was gatekeepers. Everything was like, who approves you?
But yeah,
we couldn't play at all these places. We couldn't get reviews. When we started, the New York Times would not review any show south of 14th Street.
Really?
The New Yorker would not review any. Yeah, because we promoted our own shows and we would like solicit that, you know, just to get a listing, we knew it would sell tickets.
Right.
And like, you know, you call up the person who like does just the preview section and say like, we're playing, at the Cat Club.
We're playing at Shitnick's.
Oh, the Cat Club.
You've never heard of.
Right, we're playing at PJ Shitnick's.
Yeah.
And we're wondering if you'd list our show. Like, we're doing really well. We're selling out, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, sincere. Like, you know, I'm just like a 25-year-old talking to another 25-year-old.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'd love to help you, schmo. But, like, but we do not list shows below 14th Street. When you're north of 14th Street, we will.
What the fuck is north of 14th Street?
That was the dividing line between, because.
No, but I don't even know what's north of
14th. What would they be reviewing?
Everything. Yeah, yeah. Everything. Rock clubs that adults go to.
The Beacon, places
that hold 1,000 people.
So when did it change for you guys?
Well, that didn't change till after we were playing at the Beacon before that changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that all changed in the 90s.
But how'd you get the first record deal?
Glenn Morrow, who just put out a really great record of The Replacements recently.
The live one in Hoboken?
Yeah. Ooh. I think we might have opened the night that we might have been the opening act on that bill.
The 86 at Maxwell's?
Yeah.
That's a great fucking record.
Yeah.
Wow.
Glenn Morrow ran a record label called Bar None.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, put out that record in question. And was invited. He made the tape.
Yeah.
And his partner came to us and said, would you like to make a record? And we had had a cassette that was for sale at our shows for like a year that we were selling many, many copies of.
Which had been reviewed in People magazine.
How'd that happen?
That is a really good question.
We don't know.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people.
But didn't you get some notoriety?
Yeah.
At that time for your performances and then for the answering machine stuff?
Yeah, we had the Style Song service that was kind of its own phenomenon.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting way for people to find out about us because they weren't speaking of performance art. It sort of fell into that category of...
How did it work?
It just played a song.
There was a number available?
Yeah. It was a phone machine in my kitchen and we just changed it every day. And
it was very hard to reach John at that time because you had to sit through the whole.
Yeah.
I'm listening to like me singing, going like, "Pick up the phone,
God damn it!" You know. Yeah, it was very easy. I started my sort of like Michael Sipe aloofness at that moment. but you know, a lot of people would call it up, and it was sort of its own thing. Like, people didn't necessarily even think of us as a band; they just thought of us as this phone line for a long time. And a lot of, I don't know, like it's probably not that different than
being a comedian who gets like celebrated by other comedians. There's a lot of other people, you know, Chris Butler from The Waitresses and Jules Shear, who's a big songwriter. You know, they would get us gigs at club. Our first show at Danceteria was like a gig that was arranged by somebody we didn't know.
Right.
It was just like, how can you be that nice?
Right.
Like, who gets gigs for other people they don't know?
Yeah, yeah.
But we kind of had this, people went out of their way to help us in this way. Maybe they felt sorry for us. I'm not sure exactly, but it was just like, it was like a very unusual.
Maybe we should help the two nerdy kids. Yeah, the kid with the accordion.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Lord knows they need help. But like, you know, like Marshall Crenshaw. These are people that, you know, really helped us at very specific times.
Crenshaw did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, but we didn't know them. So it was like,
well,
fans. Yeah, they were fans, and they were sort of expressing that, but it was
so you, they would bring you in to open for them, or you'd do...
Not even open. Well, that was the other thing, is we decided very early on we didn't want to open for people.
Yeah.
And that was a big mistake.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
kept you out of
it's a morale killer, I think, doing a lot of... Touring, opening for another band can really crush your spirit.
You knew well enough that you were sensensive and that you didn't want to necessarily
watch people walking in.
We just wanted to keep it fun. I think like early on we decided we wanted it, as long as it was fun, it seemed like it would be worthwhile. And it's very hard to keep it fun.
Yeah.
You know?
So you do the deal with Bar None,
and they put out this album.
First album.
Yeah. And the first video on it we made with this guy, Adam Bernstein, who's now a very, very successful, and he's a very gifted director.
Yeah.
But he basically created 30 Rock. He's like he did the pilot for 30 Rock and lots of... Yeah, Adam is a big wheel in comedy stuff.
Yeah,
And I guess he worked on.
He did your video.
He did. Yeah,
yeah, we did the first videos for pretty much zero money. Like,
but that was when MTV was relevant, right?
It was brand new. Yeah. And it was extremely important at like sort of breaking new acts. And we did we shot our videos very. It was very smart of Adam. We shot them on film,
yeah.
So they looked really different and distinctly unsweaty compared to a lot of the other, you know, like the Rolling Stones would be like shooting a video in like some hot, weird TV studio, looking very uncomfortable,
yeah.
And then our video would come on, and it would look sort of like this sort of beautiful, even though it was made for 2 cents.
Yeah, yeah. I think it also had the quality. I mean, it looks nice now, but it looked sort of archaic too.
It kind of looked like Hard Day's Night.
Like,
yeah. Oh, really? Yeah.
So like we were these clearly kind of like operating with less money, scrappy guys, and they really stood out because when we did get played on MTV, it would be between like the Whitney Houston and the White Snake videos.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was like it really stuck. And so for the people who would be inclined to like us, they were like, that was like, oh, here's something
that I can relate to.
Yeah.
Right. These two guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Who are the weirdos with the accordion?
Exactly. Yeah.
But the second one we did with Adam, which, you know, it was unclear whether it would even get played at all, but ended up being like the real breakthrough was the Don't Let Start video, which we did at in Queens at the World's Fairgrounds, which is sort of semi-abandoned, and now sadly is super demolished.
Is it?
Yeah, it's really. I think they like sort of took down the gates, and people just come in and.
Don't Let Start was on the first record.
It was on the first record. It was one of those records that it like some DJ in Pittsburgh started playing it just on his
own.
That's
a huge song, right?
Yeah, it came out pretty good.
But I mean, it did well on the charts.
Well, we've never had a number one hit in the U.S. You know, like we have yet to have an actual.
But at that time, the alternative
in the alternative scene.
But that was just the alternative was
college
just,
radio.
It was called that. College radio. Yeah, yeah. It was the college charts or college rock was what it was called. And it didn't even have what the name that it would ultimately.
But
have.
I remember hearing that song everywhere. Is that just is it just that sticky?
It was
song?
Played in a lot of bars in the East Village. I can tell you that.
Well, maybe that would have been it. What year was that? 86?
87. 87.
No, I'm still out here.
It was on K-Rock. Okay.
That's right. And in fact, the first time we came to California, that was the very first time we'd ever been anywhere where people had heard of us before we even arrived.
Uh-huh.
Like everywhere else, we built up an audience. And then by the time we were touring enough, we got all the way here. And it was really different because, like, there was a crowd of people waiting for us, which felt completely new.
And then you had, like, I mean, the second record was, like, that was, if like, what do I know? But I think Anna Ng was huge, right?
And well,
same
was
thing. It was
similar,
a college chart kind of thing.
Like
yeah,
in
yeah,
my
yeah.
mind, it's like you couldn't escape that song.
Yeah, it's inescapable.
It was like it was everywhere in my head.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you were also like in the places where it was going to. You know,
I
mean,
I guess
I'm
I
sure
was.
I'm sure there's a song right now. If you lived in Bushwick, there's a song right now by, you know, Shma and the Shmas.
That's doing
getting,
that to people.
Yeah. I mean, it's
but
just
I just
nature.
Remember. I guess so. But I'm surprised that it didn't chart on the regular charts.
It didn't, but it felt to us like we were superstars. You know? Uh-huh. I mean, that definitely.
Speaking of gatekeepers, like there was like the major labels were really concerned about holding on to the things that had already worked for them. Like, you know, this is when like Rod Stewart was still on the charts.
Yeah.
You know, like we were. Go, you know, the people on the chart, on the real charts when we were coming up were formidable, like rock, you know, stadium acts.
Sure.
So they had huge amount of money behind them. And I think the labels just, they were very reluctant to, I mean, that's what opened the door for all the indies was because they just didn't see any money there. You know?
But still that you guys were part of that wave though, that was pushing up against it that maybe didn't break until
well,
the early 90s.
I mean, we sold a lot of records on an indie label. I mean, you know, Tom and Glenn
on
at Bar None.
Yeah,
they sold
yeah.
a lot of records. They sold hundreds and hundreds of
records.
I think we did,
at some point we topped the CMJ chart.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
And you were,
exactly.
and you were cut in for the appropriate amount of money?
Oh yeah, we did. It was great.
But when did you switch labels?
We got signed to Elektra.
Why would you make that choice? Why wouldn't you stay with Bar None?
Well, there's a thing about success on success can bankrupt an indie label.
Right.
Like, they don't have the ability to ride the crazy up and down wave. I think like Glenn was happy to you know get a huge like cash buyout from Elektra for
uh-huh.
whatever it was
because it's an easier way to make money
because also like you know what if the third album comes out and they've paid us a huge advance and they print up a million copies and it doesn't sell if you're an indie that puts you straight out of business whereas if you're a major label it's just like oh that's just another that's
right.
one of 10 records that didn't work
right
but as far as for our purposes like as far as we were concerned it was also an opportunity to go you know this thing that we thought We had this notion, I think, that this is what bands do is they go to Europe and you can be a much bigger deal over there and then you ride the wave back to. And that seems like there were a lot of bands that have been doing that.
Yeah. I mean, we played in 88, 89, we played like, you know, multiple tours of Germany playing in like tiny towns.
Beer halls?
Yeah. You know, and a lot of times it would be like
with an accordion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it'd be like a GI, like American, like GI kids would come out to our shows.
Yeah.
But they were super fun shows, but they were very, very strange.
So that was our third album, Flood, we had, you know, international marketing and everything. That was a completely new thing. And
how
and
did
we
do? Did
and we did actually chart and we got on the top 10 in the UK. So
and,
that that was that did work. You know, they had enough machinery.
Sold a lot of records.
It was platinum.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was good.
Yeah.
And but you know, I mean, I think the thing is also like we had a very unneurotic relationship with a lot of times like when you hear people talk about like dealing with their record label, it's like, you know, the person who's talking is like clearly ambitious, like they want to do good stuff, they want to be successful, they're not crazy.
Yeah.
You know? And the record companies, you know, they want it to be successful. But it's like you know, it's like trying to get like pandas to mate in captivity, like you know, you have these two entities that like just for what unless the circumstance is exactly right, like they just can't get it going.
Yeah.
And like I think we were just very lucky that like we were old enough that we weren't afraid that the thing we were doing was gonna get like ruined. I think bands aren't wrong when bands are nervous about like the thing they're doing being ruined by a label, they're not wrong. You know, like that happens all the time. But we felt like we had done enough that like and we were so self-defined that even though there might be people, you know, having all sorts of big ideas about what we should do or how we should do it, it's like we were gonna be the art, you know, we were gonna steer our own ship and it didn't really matter, you know, what Mr. Guy in the executive suite says. It's like, you know, he doesn't run this band.
And did you stay with Elektra for a while?
We were on there for almost a decade.
How many records?
I think we made four
albums, yeah.
And then what happened?
Basically, they offered us a lesser advance, which is what they do when they sort of ask you to leave.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that with Elektra was that the people that had, the team that had signed us had all sort of moved on.
Right.
So there was almost nobody left.
Yeah.
The president had left. Like, it was a very different company by the end of that
And
period.
Also, like, you know, grunge had come and gone,
yeah.
and hip hop had arrived. So the whole cultural.
Did anyone sample They Might Be Giants?
Yeah, I think they thought we were easy enough to deal with, and we
no,
were.
But
hard.
I mean, did anyone use your songs in hip hop?
I'm trying
songs?
To remember.
There are some. I mean, Girl Talk samples They Might Be Giants a bunch, but I don't know who else. Uh-huh. But those aren't legal samples. So.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
we're waiting for the one to be cleared.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Like it's still in the future. Is what it is. Yeah.
DJs, listen to the sound of my voice. Sample They Might Be Giants.
There's so much stuff that you can sample.
Easy terms.
Yeah,
we got some hot beats.
The fact that you steered your own ship and you maintained the integrity of your sound and all that stuff, and you eventually added musicians and became a real band, was that a big day for you to have a drummer?
That was kind of a heart attack for us, actually.
Well, yeah, the weird thing is, there was a
tour with a band now, right? For years.
There's guys in our band. We have guys in our band who've been with us for 20 years.
Yeah.
And they're still the new guys.
You're that band now.
Yeah. It's like, when you're in this band for 35 years, you can talk about we're going to do.
You're like Daryl Jones.
The second season of Laugh-In really is the one you have to check out. Admit it.
It's like Daryl Jones. Is that
Joanne Worley, a genius.
The bass player in the Rolling Stones.
Daryl Jones, right.
25 years. Because I said that to Keith. Right. I said, I'm this Bill. Right. He's like, Bill's, Daryl's been with us for 25 years. He's the bass player. You know?
Right. Well, yeah, we had a documentary film made about us that was a very interesting thing to see. But one of the things that's weird about it is that there's this whole sort of kerfuffle created in the movie about how like our core audience didn't like the band. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say for the record, just as a sort of a corrective, or if that's the term, like as soon as we got a live band, the shows became like a complete celebration. It was like there was nothing missing.
Right.
But it did change what we, like when we were doing.
It's like me moving from the garage. It's like we said earlier, what were we talking about? When you moved to, like you're no longer in Brooklyn.
Right.
You know, like people are weird about change because then they have this conflict within them. It's like, well, I knew them when they.
Right.
And it's always going to be like, we're better because I'm me and we were younger and they were different.
Right.
And,
I mean, when we were a duo, we talked a lot between songs.
Yeah.
And a lot of that talking would sort of probably fall under the category of like comedy. I mean, like there's a lot of like, just like.
When it was just the two of us?
Yeah. We're just shooting the shit on stage and saying things that, you know, thank God.
Trying to be funny.
Yeah. We were trying to be funny and it was funny, and it was like, you know, sort of like a nervous kind of funny, but it was also like a lot of times it was stuff that like I'm very grateful there was no YouTube. I'd like to thank YouTube for not existing time.
Yeah,
but you know, and
or
then
phones that you could record on.
Yeah. And then we got the band, and when we got the band, suddenly like when you're on stage with like five other guys, you kind of want to keep the music going. Like you're not just going to sit there and like. Filibuster about like what you think of
while they're waiting
three signs.
Oh, some guys will do that though. I don't know if they do it as much anymore.
We got back into it, and that's the best part.
Yeah. So you try to crack up the band?
Oh, we yeah, absolutely.
That's the goal, right?
That's the we try. You know, it's just it's good.
And how did the stuff like, you know, having the theme song for Malcolm, that must have been a nice paycheck for a long time.
Yeah, that was kind of a page turned around the turn of the century, I guess, for us, because we'd had a band for a while, but we had still not done, as I said, we were holding off on doing other projects, like not just the kids' music, but commercial stuff of any kind.
You mean the actual product support?
But also doing movie music. I mean, I think
you
we
held
would
off
have liked,
on it.
We would have liked to have done movie music earlier than we did.
One thing we noticed the moment we left Elektra was that our phone. We actually got the phone calls that came in for us.
Oh, right.
So all of a sudden,
they've been keeping from
right. It's like, well, maybe that would be better project for Bjork. You know, right. Like,
But part of it, I mean, earlier we had been just saying no to everything.
Because of the sellout issue.
Yeah, which was just like a youngster kind of
sure.
Thing.
But we ended up doing a ton of TV stuff. We did like the Daily Show. We recorded the Bob Mould's song for the Daily Show.
Uh-huh.
And we so like the ba ba da ba da. That's
you
us.
Guys.
That's us.
Yeah.
And we did.
They still use that?
They do.
Yeah.
They use a remix version of our recording now instead of.
The original? Yeah.
Instead of the original, but it's still
you?
Still us.
Uh-huh.
And, but it's really Bob. I mean, he wrote the theme.
Sure.
Although we wrote the second part of the theme.
Yeah.
But, and then we did like, you know, the Malcolm thing, which like was huge. I mean, it was.
Was that a pre-existing song or you asked to write that?
It was like a half written song and it only had to be 30 seconds long. So it was like, I got it right here. you know, and it kind of fit the energy of the show because we knew it was about
boys. But that's
a
nice payout, right? I mean.
Well, they didn't pay us a ton of money at first, but it's, you know, over time it's, you know, because it's in syndication and the residuals and stuff like that, we get it.
You still get it.
Oh, sure. Yeah. The long envelopes arrive.
Yeah. But that was, I mean, that's the main thing because we entered this whole time, which is of doing things where nobody even knows it's us.
Yeah.
People don't know it's us doing
like
the,
what?
The Daily Show.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah. But I don't know a lot of things.
Well, almost nobody. Well, I mean, even our fans, a lot of them don't know that we're doing that.
Like what other things? What are the
the Malcolm theme.
Sure.
Amazing Vacation Homes.
Oh, yeah? What is that? That's
it's on the Travel Channel.
Oh, you did the theme?
Yeah. We did a lot of themes for like these sort of cable-y shows, you know? I mean,
because you just can knock them out or what?
Yeah. We did, you know.
Your go-to guys for that stuff?
We tried. We were
more in the beginning of this century, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we got a Grammy for the Malcolm thing. And then all of a sudden, like, then the phone's ringing off the hook. So,
yeah.
Because it's like you're actually L.A., you know, like you're in the mix in Hollywood. You win a Grammy, it's like you're
you're
token LA people.
And yet that, how did you reconcile selling out with what you were about to be doing?
Well, the thing that was nice about the TV stuff is that it was faceless. Like that it wasn't really, you know.
You weren't singing.
It was the reputation, by and large.
But I think we also just got over the notion of like, we also did a whole string of Dunkin' Donuts ads.
Oh, yeah.
And we were hired to basically do us, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, we want you guys.
Yeah.
We weren't identified in the ads.
But people knew.
But my wife instantly, when she saw it, she was like.
But as a project, that was a blast. Like, we were doing original.
I like Dunkin' Donuts.
Well, part of the thing that's fun about doing stuff like TV themes is if you're actually doing some. It's one thing to like license your band's established hit and kind of like have somebody take your vibe and brand it on their thing.
Right.
It's something else like to actually collaborate with people and make something new. It's fun to make something new.
Well, and also like if you can, you know, confidently be okay with the product, it's just part of the work. On some level, it's like this is another revenue stream, and someone's got to compose this stuff, and there is challenges to it that I think ultimately inform other things.
Well, and also like just to be, you know, just get right down to it, like, you know, if there was ever a band that was like part of television, They Might Be Giants is clearly a band that has watched television.
Yeah.
You know, and like, you know, growing up with
that's
the Twilight,
how you're gonna reconcile it.
You know,
we are television.
No, but I mean, like, just like growing up with like,
we can't sell out because
we're inside the television. No, I mean, just like, you know, growing up with like the Twilight Zone theme, growing up with like TV music, it's like such a part of your consciousness.
So I think it's a very personal thing to decide what your threshold for being compromised artistically.
Well, what's
you know,
there's a ton of things we definitely don't do.
It's something you feel and you know it when you feel it, but it's hard
to define
true.
It.
Yeah, you know?
I think so.
There's a concept that comes up on this show a lot, which is like being liked the wrong way, which I think is a really interesting idea because I think it's especially true of, I mean, I know that comedians, like, they'll feel like it's like, they were laughing, but they were laughing the wrong way. I think musicians are even more tuned into that idea. Like, you really want to be liked, just it's got to be right. It's got to be the right way.
Like, but if you're like, you know, Bruce Springsteen, you know, and you've got some Yahoo Meathead fans.
I hadn't thought about that.
You know, you're going to have to. You know, make peace with that a little bit, you know, because I went to a Cold Steady show years ago.
I would never think about that. I just met him. He's such a nice man.
Oh, he's great. But like, you know, there is, you know, an element. There's a broad sort of poetic element to the Bruce oeuvre.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, like, you know, the working class, you know, what he means to people. And it transcends politics. But, you know, I went to a Hold Steady show at South by Southwest early on before I even knew who they were. And I'm like looking at some of these people and I'm like, this, you know, Craig is such a sensitive, you know, thoughtful kind of embrace. And like, these guys are frat guys. Like, and, you know, there's got to be an element like, no, there they are again.
Really? Is that really true? The Hold Steady, I would think the whole SETI audience would be like the highest percentage of like lit majors.
Yeah, dude. I mean, like, you know, that album that got big for them, you know, was a big record.
Yeah.
It's a big college record. And yeah. I mean, Cobain talked about it too. He wrote a fucking song about it.
Right.
That, you know, that these people aren't going to understand the poetry or the sensitivity or even the tone of what you're doing.
I feel like I shield myself. I mean, if there is an element of people in,
yeah.
in the audience.
Well, I don't know that, if they, I don't know that you guys have them. I don't.
Do, although we do have a thing online where if we ever say like, you know, I'm really interested in like evolution and somebody who writes in on the Twitter feed who's like, I thought you guys were cool.
Right. You know? The YouTube like, comments on like anything related to science is like, forget
on anything.
Forget it.
On anything, period. So we talked a little bit about like, about the children's stuff, but wait, what is the, do you have a relationship with Disney?
No,
we did,
not
we
now.
Did. We put out in
we
the
did three
O's,
projects.
We did a bunch of kids projects for DVDs for Disney, and they were
they
themed.
Asked you?
Yeah. Yeah.
After the first album, the first kids album like took off, like they were like very, very interested in working with us.
And what happened to that?
It was good. It was great. It was a fun thing.
Was it fun to be part of that legacy in a way?
Well, it was the president of Disney was this nutty rogue dude named David Agnew who was just basically sticking his neck out for us because he allowed us to do it our own way. So it really didn't feel like the mouse's three fingers were pushing down on our heads.
We had total control over everything, and David made sure that was what it was. So we were in a very unique spot. I mean, we previously had done, you know, it's a big difference like to work for Disney and then work with Disney.
Right.
There's a big distinction to be made.
Sure.
And we had did some job that I think technically we were fired from for some Disney animated movie, and they just were like, this, we don't like this at all.
Really?
You know, please revise this.
God, that would seem like a whether it's Disney or not, it would seem like you guys could do like almost all the music for, you could be like the new Randy Newmans for Pixar and stuff.
Well, you know, say that one more time.
You guys could be the next Randy Newman.
We just did this song for the SpongeBob musical, and they did a very great bunch of staging for it. It really turns it into a big number in the show.
Uh-huh.
And it's very gratifying. Like we're in this amazing company of like David Bowie did a song for it, and like there's an Aerosmith song in it. So there's all these like big deal show business people in it. But it was nice that like we actually got a chance to be part of it. I mean, we're essentially still an indie act. So
yeah, you know, and you're open to doing that kind of stuff.
Well, we love to do more stuff where we just send them the demo and then we get to just sit around the house.
We're especially into the big money stuff.
Yeah.
So you'd like to do big money stuff where you don't have to travel.
Yeah.
And also that's easy.
Easy. Yes,
easy's good. I don't know. How do you get those?
How do we get that job?
I don't know. Maybe someone will hear this and
say, wait.
We have just the kind of thing where you can sit down and make a lot of money.
I also wanted to mention Netflix. Yeah.
Okay. You need some Netflix money?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny how like these, if you're around long enough, you see these cycles of crazy money happening.
Yeah.
I feel like right now it's like an especially crazy money time
for people.
All these things.
Yeah.
For these things.
For Netflix. Yeah. I mean, I'm just happy to be making a living.
Right.
Right. Ultimately.
I think we're all, you know, everybody's in it for the long haul.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, I remember when, like, all the dot-com first generation stuff came around.
Yeah.
And we would get, like, you know, flown out to L.A. and, like, get some tour of some weird, or San Francisco, and be like some place that's, like, every single thing is white.
Yeah.
And, like, there's a guy.
Sure.
There's a non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah.
Just to go in the house?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, who did that? Mr. Show did such a great riff on that with Dave Cross playing the guy who invented the delete button.
Oh, yeah.
And the goats and the tofutti breaks. That was genius.
The amount of venom that he has for that is very satisfying.
Well, hopefully there'll be more good times like that ahead.
Sure, more free money. You're hoping for more
delete buttons.
It'll be some Bitcoin-y thing, probably.
I don't even know where you buy those or how you get your money.
You got to get on the dark web.
I'm not. Okay, that's it.
That's where I get my drugs.
Oh, see, Mom, you waited till the end.
She's got bored. She stopped listening. Now we can talk.
So what's going on? You guys, you got a new record, or it just came out in January?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
What's that one called?
It's called I Like Fun.
And it's your 39th record?
39th.
Yep.
49th.
But what's weird, and speaking of things going in cycles, is it's getting really good. Like 4 records ago, we had a record that got really good reviews. And this one's getting really good reviews, too. So we're just riding the good vibes of the good reviews.
Well, good. It is a lot of records. Are you doing another kids record?
No.
Okay. Wow. That's
that was very you said that very quickly.
Final. Very.
Who knows?
It's over. No more. We've done it.
Who could say, Mark? Who could say?
If the money was right and it didn't take a lot of work.
That but you see, the problem is that we have a commitment to quality that...
Oh, see, that's what's slowing us down. That's the rub, man.
Right,
for
the
simple, easy, huge money on the couch.
Well, it's, I mean, the SpongeBob was a great nexus of the quality was good.
Yeah,
and it was an easy.
I have complete confidence you guys to continue on. You seem well.
Well, congratulations to you on all your stuff.
Well, thank you. It was a long time coming, and I'm almost enjoying it.
I like the happy Mark.
Oh boy, yeah.
Are you coming out to New York anytime?
I was going to come out in a couple of weeks, but
let's have an overpriced meal together.
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll get the art. Let's get the artists together.
Our treat.
Okay.
Excellent
deal. Thanks, Johns.
Thank you.
Okay, all right, that was that. That was them. That was They Might Be Giants. That was fun, though, right? They feel like old friends to me. You know, they've been around. Their music has been around. They were just, they developed with me in their thing, and I developed over here in my thing, and occasionally I'd listen to their music, and then I got to talk to them. All right, well, before I go, for the last time talking in this garage, we're about 2 weeks away from a few parts of the world tour in Europe. Go to WTFpod.com/tour to get venue and ticket information for London, Stockholm, Oslo, Amsterdam, and Dublin. And I guess I'll try to play a little guitar. I don't have much equipment here, but I might as well play guitar for the last time in here. Oh, no. Okay.
Boomer lives!